Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to book 13, chapter 19. And it goes a little bit like this. A man in motion always devises an aim for that motion. To be able to go 1,000 versts, he must imagine that something good awaits him at the end of those 1,000 versts. One must have the prospect of a promised land to have the strength to move. The promised land for the French, during their advance, had been Moscow. During their retreat, it was their native land. But that native land was too far off, and for a man going 1,000 versts, it is absolutely necessary to set aside his final goal and to say to himself, "Today I shall get to a place 40 versts off, where I shall rest and spend the night." And during the first day's journey, that resting place eclipses his ultimate goal and attracts all his hopes and desires. And the impulses felt by a single person are always magnified in a crowd. For the French retreating along the old Smolensk road, the final goal, their native land, was too remote, and their immediate goal was Smolensk, towards which all their desires and hopes enormously intensified in the mass urged them on. It was not that they knew that much food and fresh troops awaited them in Smolensk, nor that they were told so. On the contrary, their superior officers and Napoleon himself knew that provisions were scarce there. But because this alone could give them strength to move on and endure their present privations, so both those who knew and those who did not know deceived themselves and pushed on to Smolensk as to the promised land. Coming out onto the high road, the French fled with surprising energy and unheard-of rapidity towards the goal they had fixed on. Besides the common impulse which had bound the whole crowd of French into one mass and supplied them with a certain energy, there was another cause binding them together, their great numbers. As with the physical law of gravity, their enormous mass drew the individual human atoms to itself. In their hundreds of thousands, they moved like a whole nation. Each of them desired nothing more than to give himself up as a prisoner, to escape from all this horror and misery. But, on the one hand, the force of this common attraction to Smolensk, their goal, drew each of them in the same direction. On the other hand, an army corps could not surrender to a company. And though the French availed themselves of every convenient opportunity to detach themselves and to surrender, on the slightest decent pretext, such pretext did not always occur. Their very numbers and their crowded and swift movement deprived them of that possibility, and rendered it not only difficult but impossible for the Russians to stop this movement to which the French were directing all their energies. Beyond a certain limit, no mechanical disruption of the body could hasten the process of decomposition. A lump of snow cannot be melted instantaneously. There is a certain limit of time in less than which no amount of heat can melt the snow. On the contrary, the greater the heat, the more solidified the remaining snow becomes. Of the Russian commanders, Kutuzov alone understood this. When the flight of the French army along the Smolensk road became well defined, what Konovnitsyn had foreseen on the night of the 11th of October began to occur. The superior officers all wanted to distinguish themselves, to cut off, to seize, to capture, and to overthrow the French, and all clamoured for action. Kutuzov alone used all his power, and such power is very limited in the case of any commander-in-chief, to prevent an attack. He could not tell them what we say now. Why fight? Why block the road, losing our own men and inhumanly slaughtering unfortunate wretches? What is the use of that when a third of their army has melted away on the road from Moscow to Vyazma without any battle? But drawing from his aged wisdom what they could understand, he told them of the Golden Bridge, and they laughed at him and slandered him, flinging themselves on, rending and exulting over the dying beast. Ermolov, Milodorovich, and Platov, and others in proximity to the French near Vyazma, could not resist their desire to cut off and break up two French corps, and by way of reporting their intention to Kutuzov, they sent him a blank sheet of paper in an envelope. And try as Kutuzov might to restrain the troops, our men attacked, trying to bar the road. Infantry regiments were, we are told, advanced to the attack with music and with drums beating, and killed and lost thousands of men. But they did not cut off or overthrow anybody. And the French army, closing up more firmly at the danger, continued, while steadily melting away, to pursue its fatal path to Smolensk. End of book 13. There we go, another chapter down and another book down. And being that we've got to the end of the book, let's do our usual thing and recap. This is a pretty short recap here, because a lot of these chapters are bundled up into pieces, into smaller pieces. Chapters 1 through 7, the cause of historical events, a survey of movements of the Russian army after leaving Moscow, Napoleon's letter to Kutuzov, the camp at Tarutino, Alexander's letters to Kutuzov, Ermolov and others absent when wanted, the battle is postponed, Kutuzov's wrath, the action the next day, Cossacks surprise Murat army and capture prisoners, guns and booty, and then inactivity of the rest of the army. Chapters 8 through to 10, Napoleon's measures, a proclamation in Moscow, the effects of pillaging on French discipline. Then we had Pierre, his 4 weeks in captivity, Karatayev and a French soldier. The French leave Moscow, and there's a drum, Pierre's mental change, he recovers his grip on life. Exit of troops and prisoners, the road is then blocked, and Pierre reflects. Finally, we had the Russian army, Dokhturov, news of the French having left Moscow, reaching Kutuzov at night, his emotion. Cossacks nearly capture Napoleon at Malo Yaroslavets. Napoleon retreats by Smolensk Road, and a third of his army melts away before reaching Vyazma. And that's a summary of Book 13. Not a great bit of the book, in my opinion, Book 13. I mean, in all the 19 chapters of Book 13, I think we were only with our characters for 3 or maybe 4. It was something like 15 chapters of just war movements, context, exposition, that sort of thing. I didn't really enjoy it, if I'm frank. I think it's fair to assume that the Reddit community, A Year of War and Peace, didn't really get much out of these chapters either, because for the last 2 weeks or so, there's been no comments, or maybe 1 or 2 comments at the very most, but more often than not, no comments on all about every chapter. The social activity on the discussion forums has completely died down, and I think it's because people just don't have much to say about these chapters. I did notice any chapter where we went back and visited our characters again had a little bit more conversation, but other than that, it was pretty quiet. Chattel Valster said, in today's chapter, Tolstoy has a few theories why the French army is able to retreat so quickly and why it's currently so strong even though it's melting. Do you agree with his theories in this chapter, and do you like the comparison he makes? That's the comparison about ice melting, and that the stronger the heat is melting the ice, the harder the core of the ice becomes, something like that. Seems to make sense as an analogy, but still doesn't really explain why that happened or how that happened in human terms. If it was a bunch of water melting, it might make sense, but yeah, no, it doesn't make sense to me. But also, I didn't get the impression that the French army was particularly strong. It kind of seemed at the end there like the Russians were just sort of picking on them. Picking them off, cutting them off, and harassing them as they make their escape. And it wasn't that Kutuzov wasn't afraid to attack because he thought they would lose. He just thought, they're running away. By attacking, we will win, but we'll also lose our own troops and become injured at the same time. So why throw perfectly good people at an enemy who is already retreating. It seemed to him just, I suppose, egotistical. It was generals and army people trying to get a kill under their belt or get some merit from the war. But he saw that as sort of greedy. Chatterbalster also said, because there hasn't been much discussion during this part of the book, I'm assuming that it wasn't as interesting for everybody as other parts were. If this is the case, what are you hoping to read in the next part? So Chatterbalster's noticed the same thing as I have, which is interesting. Personally, what am I hoping to read in the next chapter? I just want to be back with our characters. I wish that Tolstoy would have a way to mix in what's happening with the army with our characters and have it relevant to our characters. Maybe have them discovering these things or them discussing these things, because it almost seems like we go away, we learn what the army's doing, we learn what's happening in the wider world, but it doesn't even seem relevant to the characters. When we come back to the character, you wonder if they even know all this stuff that we've just discussed. It's like too separated from the characters. Alright, that's probably going to do us for this chapter and for book 13. I'll see you again tomorrow for book 14. Thanks for listening.